you're a little scary sometimes. You know that. Brilliant. Scary.
You're listening to Voxic Shock, because ignorance won't save you.
A financial panic gripped the world.
I decided, if it's all right with you, to appoint myself morale officer.
This will be the madness for Britain.
Those memories of fear are coming back.
I don't care what anybody says about the new world order. I don't trust that guy.
He has no idea what it's like out there. None!
Now here's Vox Day. He doesn't expect you to agree, and he doesn't expect you to understand.
Today, we are pleased and privileged to have Carl Denninger. He is one of the foremost commentators on the economic and financial situation of the last 3 years. Carl, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Back in October 2008, you wrote that Bernanke's Great Depression thesis was a folly. What was wrong with that thesis, and what is your opinion concerning the present possibility of a double-dip recession?
Oh, I think it's in the bag. More importantly, we never actually left the first dip. And this is difficult for people to get their arms around because you see the statistics that are published all the time, you know, the GDP growth of whatever. You have to subtract out from those numbers the amount of debt that was taken on in the system for other than productive purposes, in other words, for something other than an investment. And the reason you have to do that is that if I borrow money to buy an iPod, for example, I've not actually added to the output of the economy. What I've done is time shifted when that output happens. So I've bought something today that I then cannot buy tomorrow because I not only have to pay that loan back, I have to pay the interest on it. When you do this, you find that from 1983 forward, we have not had an actual positive GDP in this country. We have borrowed all of it. And what happened in 2007 and 2008 is that the federal government, in conspiracy with the Federal Reserve, open conspiracy, no attempt to hide it, took the borrowing that no longer could take place in the private economy and shifted it into the taxpayer's balance sheet, essentially made it a public liability. And when you take the amount of that borrowing in excess of the deficits that Bush was running at the time, which, by the way, he did in order to cover up the recession from 2000 to 2003.
Yeah, people have a tendency to forget that there was a bailout previous to the Obama administration. Obama's stimulus plan was actually the second one.
So, well, actually, it was the third one.
Third, actually, yeah, because we're forgetting 2001.
Yeah, the third one. Actually, the first goes back to when Continental Illinois blew up and resulted in what would have at the time been a really nasty dislocation. It was in the 1980s. And that was around the time of the S&L crisis. Continental Illinois took on a bunch of bad paper from Penn Square, which then failed. They were bailed out by the FDIC, even though there was no statutory authority in reality for the FDIC to do that. They did it anyway. And that is where the idea that you could buy bank debt without any risk of actually having to suffer a loss came from. It came from the previous acts of the government back in the 1980s.
So you're already answering a question that I had prepared for you, which is, do you expect a similar repetition of TARP and the 2008 banking bailouts?
No.
Really?
And the reason is that we have now reached the end of the rope on the government side.
Okay.
And so what we've done is, through two cycles, transferred losses that should have been borne by investors who made bad bets. And there's nothing wrong with being an investor and making a bad bet. You just lose your money. That's what happens. But we transferred those losses to the public balance sheet directly and indirectly. In the 2000s, what we did was we goaded people into taking loans on houses at ever-increasing prices, which could not possibly be financed to maturity. But the banks didn't care because all they were interested in doing was making their spread and then selling them off to some sucker who was going to get stuck with the loss. In this cycle, what we've done is there are no more ordinary people who can take on debt. I mean, if you look at the consumer credit reports, it was just a new one released a few minutes ago, and I haven't had time to go through it yet. But what we've seen since this collapse began in 2007 is that the only sector of consumer credit that is expanding is student loans. So we are screwing our young people who are ignorant. They're not stupid. They're just ignorant. We don't teach them this stuff in school. They are the only ones left to try to load more debt in the Ponzi onto. Everybody else has wised up and has said no more.
If you look at the Z1 report, you can see that the only sector overall that is really growing is the federal government sector. Even the state and local governments are flat, whereas the household sector and the financial sector, are declining dramatically, and they have been since 2008.
That's right. And the really nasty part of that Z1 is that if you look at the contraction in financial credit, that is things like credit default swaps and basically bank-to-bank institutional credit, not loans to productive businesses, you find that the amount of spending that has been done at a deficit level beyond what Bush spent is an almost exact match for the contraction in that outstanding credit within financial institutions. So what this means is that you and I and everybody else in the country have forcibly been put in a position of having to cover the bad debts of these financial institutions. We have literally had that money stolen from us and added on as public debt that we are now responsible for, and that money was given to the banks.
Voxic Shock will be right back. WND Books presents Jerome Corsi's New York Times and Amazon bestseller, Where's the Birth Certificate?
Preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
So help you God?
So help me God.
How can you preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States if, as running for president, you haven't even established you meet the eligibility requirements of being a natural-born citizen? Presidents who try to cover up are doing so at their own detriment. As long as they're secrets, as long as they're covered up, the American people will not have the truth. Americans need to know what's in this book.
Jerome Corsi's Where's the Birth Certificate?
I'm an atheist, and I resent being called a socially autistic, God-hating mouth breather with unresolved daddy issues. I also hate how everyone tries to shove their religion down my throat by praying in public and celebrating holidays such as Christmas. We know there's no God because we have science and reason, and because Christians did the Crusades and made all the wars in history, and because they have imaginary friends in the sky. Yet they keep talking like we're the bad guys just because we attack their beliefs and point out their ignorance even though no one asked us. And even though I'm an atheist who's lonely, overweight, and male, it doesn't mean we all are. There was that redhead from the Rational Response Squad. Oh wait, she ran off to Vegas. Anyhow, now there's a place for us to go and be ourselves, the Persecuted Atheist Club. There aren't any women there, but we do have a flat screen in all 7 seasons of Star Trek The Next Generation. The PAC, No Gods Allowed.
Are atheists on the side of reason? Is a bear a Catholic? In the Irrational Atheist, Vox Dei destroys the arguments of Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, and other godless wonders. The Irrational Atheist, in bookstores and $1.99 on Kindle. Now, back to Vox Dei and Carl Denninger on Voxic Shock.
Along with Max Kaiser, you are one of the foremost critics of the international banking system. What is it about the system that you deem so pernicious to the economy and to the nation?
The most important factor within the banking system that causes these problems is the ability of banks to create unbacked credit and then load off the cost on someone else. When you are an investor or a trader in the stock market and you are trading stocks, there is a practice that was very common in the 1990s, and in fact it was fairly common up until the collapse when the SEC finally started to stomp on it, and that was naked shorting of securities. In other words, shorting stock that you could not borrow from somebody. When you did that, you were effectively counterfeiting the stock of that company because you were pretending. It's like taking money from someone that you're going to sell them a Cadillac, okay? But you don't have a Cadillac. And you can't acquire a Cadillac in the time that you have to deliver it to the person who gives you the money. You've effectively stolen their funds by operation of a fraudulent edifice. When a bank creates credit against no asset at all, in other words, when they give you a loan on a credit card, unless they have actual money from an investor, that is what they are doing. They are creating a naked short on the currency. Well, the only entity that has the right to a currency is the sovereign itself, that is the government of whatever state or nation you're involved with. So the United States federal government has the authority to issue currency. It's explicitly in the Constitution. Congress has that power. A commercial bank does not have the power to emit United States dollars. And yet, when you create unbacked loans, that is exactly what you're doing. We have this fantasy that we can continue to do this on an indefinite basis, forever expanding this supply of credit, and we're never going to run into a problem where the actual production is insufficient to pay those loans off. That, of course, is not true.
Speaking of being unable to continue piling debt upon debt, you've been writing a lot about Greece recently, as the situation there appears to be even worse than it was when the first $146 billion bailout package was put together last May. And yet, the euro has been strengthening against the dollar. So is the situation worse in Europe or in the USA?
It's difficult to tell exactly what's going on with the euro and dollar trade. Part of the problem with Greece is that what the Greek government did was essentially hide large amounts of their sovereign debt through the use of credit instruments.
Thank you, Goldman.
Thank you very much, Goldman Sachs. They were involved in it. They were not the only ones, though. Apparently, if reports are correct, the government itself was writing these things. So, I mean, there's a clear question here as to whether or not the executive within Greece even had the authority to do that, or whether that authority rested with the parliament. I'm not familiar enough with the Greek constitution, Greek law to know, but it certainly smells bad, especially when you're doing this stuff under the table and it's not being disclosed out in public. The problem that Greece has is that there is essentially their debt at this point is trading at recovery value. Nobody pays a 20% coupon on 2-year notes, okay?
Right.
What's being priced in there is that you're going to take a 40% haircut. and so the recovery on the default is what the coupon is trading at. That is inevitable. There's literally no way out of the box here. What the European Union is attempting to do now, and the ECB, is essentially force the Greeks to sell assets, essentially cannibalizing their country in order to cover these debts. Now, why the Greek government and the Greek people would consent to this is beyond me. Sovereign lending always happens unsecured. In other words, when you borrow money as a country, you are borrowing money predicated upon one power and one power only, and that is the ability to tax out of your economy the money necessary to pay it back in the future. Okay,
that's just not possible in Greece because
right.
About 30% of their economy is just government spending anyhow, so it's just not an option.
There's really no way for the Greek government to avoid a default and a restructuring. And restructuring is simply, I'm going to give you 50 cents on a dollar or whatever it is that we're going to do, but you're not going to get all your money.
Sure, and the same thing's true in Ireland and Spain and Portugal and so forth.
Spain is possibly salvageable from the back of the envelope numbers I've run, but the ultimate issue here is that this excess credit creation has to come out of the system. It has to come out of the system in Europe. It has to come out of the system in the United States. And what everyone is attempting to do here is avoid that reality. And the reason it's being avoided 3-4 years into this is that when this all blew up, we found out, of course, when Lehman Brothers went down, that the real problem was that these banks had issued credit protection, credit default swaps and interest rate swaps, which they had no money to clear. Now, I as a trader cannot do this in the markets because my positions are marked to the market nightly and I'm required to post cash margin if I am upside down on anything I'm doing. So
right.
if my positions go against me, I have to put up more money as that happens. And this is the way it should be for everybody. All right? We all ought to be playing a level playing field, whether we're a government or whether we're an individual or a bank. But in the over-the-counter world, this is not the case. And so you have a situation here where you have bonds being held by these institutions that are being claimed as worth 100 cents on the dollar. The market is saying that they're worth 40 to 50 cents on the dollar. And the difference is the hit to the capital of that institution that would be taken were reality to be recognized. The institutions get around this by buying credit protection, but the problem is the person they bought them from doesn't have the money to pay. So this is the same thing that happened in 2008. We're in the same box, and the market is levitating on this idea that somehow everyone's going to find a way to say kumbaya and dance down towards the end of the pier and somehow avoid getting pushed off and getting eaten by sharks. I ultimately don't believe that that's possible, that these can-kicking exercises at some point come to an end, because at some point in time you have to extract the production from the people in order to pay these guys. I mean, at some point that has to happen. There isn't, you can't manufacture money out of thin air. If you try to print money in order to cause this, in order to fix this, then the price of everything goes up And the same thing happens. Consumption gets destroyed because I have to buy food, I have to buy fuel, and what I have left for disposable purchasing power goes down.
But what you're describing here with the can-kicking of the European Central Bank and the Greek government is exactly the same stuff that's going on with the Federal Reserve and the Treasury. It's what a lot of people have called extend and pretend. But what are they hoping to accomplish through this extending and pretending? What light is there at the end of the tunnel that they're waiting for?
The original concept behind this in 2007, if you remember, this goes back to when the two hedge funds blew up in August of 2007. And Ben Bernanke put in place a emergency discount rate cut on options expiration. He cost me $100,000 that day when he did that, by the way.
Kind of a...
It cost a lot of people a lot of money. We were correctly short based upon the macro environment, what was going on, and he rammed a huge rally up everybody's backside by doing this. This is what central banks traditionally will do. We just, you know, we got the inflection point wrong. I didn't think it was going to happen that day because Alan Greenspan had done something very similar intraday during the 2000 wreck, and it had such a monstrous impact that nobody ever believed that a central banker would do something that stupid again. Well, we were wrong. But the intent here was that the private economy would take over, and private credit creation and credit acceptance would be able to pick back up the, you know, the Ponzi scheme of leverage upon leverage upon leverage. Unfortunately, the central bankers got this wrong. The consumer is out of debt acceptance capacity. This is why we hit the wall in the first place. People couldn't make their mortgage payments. So now you get into a situation where you get, you know, year into this, 2 years into this, of course, you know, after the first year, then Lehman goes down, Fannie and Freddie explode. And now you run into the problem that in Washington, D.C., there are a few words you will never hear, and the three most important ones are, I screwed up. So now you have Ben, who is absolutely convinced, based upon his doctoral thesis, that if he just keeps doing this long enough, that the private economy and the private citizens will pick back up and start borrowing money again, which is what's necessary in order to, you know, in order to perpetuate the cycle. The problem is we're, you know, we're, like I said, we're 3 years into this now, almost four, and where is the private borrowing coming from? Well, as I said, there's only one place it's showing up in the data, and that is in student loans. Everybody else is saying, no, we're not going to do this anymore.
Yeah, it's not so much extend and pretend as exacerbate and destroy.
Well, it's also just lie, okay? I mean, the part of, you have to look at, for example, at bank balance sheets. There are a huge number of home equity line of credit and second lines that are on these sheets. Most of those loans were not securitized. They're actually held by the banks. And so these loans are being held at or very near full value. If you pull up a 10Q or a 10K for any of these banks and you look at their portfolio, you'll see that they've taken very little in the way of impairments against those.
And the second line mortgages, given that the first mortgage is underwater, the second mortgage is totally worthless. Nothing.
That's right. They're totally worthless. And 70% of the dollar volume in those things was written in the sand states. Okay, that's Nevada, Arizona, California, Florida. So you have 70% of the dollar volume in a place where, you know, 40% of the houses are underwater on the first. Right? So a realistic mark on these loans is probably 60% of face value. Okay, that's probably realistic.
Voxic Shock will be right back.
The Federal Reserve has turned on the printing presses. Gasoline prices are soaring. The euro is imploding. And over the last 95 years, the value of a dollar has dropped to a nickel. How can you protect yourself from the madness? The same way the Greeks and Romans did in their day. Buy metal. At over $1,500 per ounce, gold is more expensive than it's ever been. But you can still afford silver. At livesilverprices.net, you can keep up on the current price of silver, look up historical silver prices, and learn the different ways to invest in silver. So fight inflation and help build financial security with livesilverprices.net. That's livesilverprices.net.
Now, back to Vox Day and Carl Denninger on Voxic Shock.
Well, it's interesting. I was just going to ask you this question. I said, by my calculations, which are based on comparing the bad assets and losses reported by the FDIC when they seize a bank, about 39% of the assets being held by America's banks are non-existent. That's about a reasonable approximation.
Yeah, that's about right. I've written on that repeatedly. We've got some data from some publicly traded stuff. You know, Colonial went down as one example. And, you know, here we are with assets they reported on their quarterly report a few weeks earlier, and all of a sudden they've magically lost 40% of their value. Well, you know, that can't happen, you know, in the space of a couple of weeks. So one of two things obviously is true. Either the quarterly report was wrong and they were lying, or the FDIC was derelict in its duty, or both. Remember that the FDIC has a body of law called Prompt Corrective Action, which
right.
has the word shall in it all over the place and does not have the word may essentially anywhere. And yet all those shalls don't seem to have actually produced what was supposed to occur. So we have federal agencies that essentially have stuck their head in the sand instead of doing their job. And that's a big part of where the problem has come from here. We have resolution authorities that were put into place after the S&L crisis to prevent exactly this kind of thing from happening. Bill Black was instrumental in putting over 1,000 people in jail. And you know, one of the things that came out of that crisis was prompt corrective action and major rewrites to the law governing FDIC conduct, because the FDIC, after bailing out Continental Illinois, along with the FSOIC, which of course was folded into the FDIC after the S&Ls went down, was essentially doing the same sort of thing. They were sitting on their hands and playing with themselves instead of doing their jobs. So supposedly this can't happen again, but as you've seen, it has.
Well, it doesn't matter if the law is written if no one's going to enforce it. Now, let's step back a bit from the specifics and look at, you mentioned the macroeconomic side of things. Who are some of the economists that you follow on a regular basis, and who do you think has a good handle on the present situation?
Nobody. The answer to the second part of the question. I read just about everything I can get my hands on. Okay, so I mean, I see all kinds of things, but one of the themes that I continue to see is people saying that, you know, we've had this recovery in there's been a small recovery in C&I loans, for example, commercial industrial. But the problem is that our economy is 70% consumption, all right, one form or another. And we're now 65-70% services. But in terms of the commonwealth of the nation, if you will, it rests in manufacturing. And the problem that we run into is the differential between input prices and output. And so you have this commodity ramp that's been going on now for the last year and a half. I started screaming about this back last August, and I said, this is going to take about 9 months to really start to bite people, because that's about how long it takes for raw materials to work their way all the way through the chain. All right. And historically speaking, that's the timeline. And 9 to 12 months is about when things start to go wrong, when you get these big dislocations in input prices. And they started to show up in the PPI numbers back last August, in August of 2010.
I was reading you. I remember.
Yeah. And you know, the funny thing is nobody has said anything about this. I mean, Rick Santelli has noted, you know, hey, listen, that's a hot number, you know. But you haven't seen, you know, the economists have said, oh, you know, it'll produce a little bit of a soft patch, we'll get through this, yada, yada, yada. The problem is that we've been blowing 12% roughly of GDP in borrowed money at the federal government level, but we cannot manage to produce a jobs number out of all of this time. We've been doing this now for 3 years. We've yet to produce one jobs number over more than a couple of months of run rate that actually has been above replacement rate in the population. You got to remember, we have to put about 150,000 to 200,000 people into the workforce every month just to cover the people that come into the workforce and graduating from high school and such. All right. So that's the baseline number. You need about 2 million jobs a year that are added. And yet the labor participation rate of the never recovered after the 2000 recession. We papered over that with additional debt. And yet it is that participation rate that gives the government the ability to tax people, which is where we get the ability to pay for what we want to do with the government.
And of course, as people continue to drop out of the participation and the labor force, then the ability to tax them declines and you end up in this vicious circle.
That's right. And we're in a place right now, in terms of labor participation rate, we're approximately where we were before women went into the workforce en masse in the 1970s and 1980s.
Yeah, I actually wrote a column about that about 2 weeks ago. Let's look at the political side now. In 2008, you endorsed and voted for a Democrat for the first time in your life, Barack Obama. 2.5 years later, Do you find that you have any regrets about that? And what did you think when it looked as if his very first order of business was appointing a cabinet that was entirely composed of former Goldman Sachs officials?
Well, I want to throw up. voting for him was simply a matter of the fact that John McCain suspended his campaign to cause the passage of a bill that was directly violative of every American's personal sovereignty and fiscal responsibility. There were not enough votes in the Senate to pass TARP when John McCain suspended his campaign. And let's not forget that Sarah Palin was part of that campaign as well.
Absolutely.
All right, so Sarah Palin is just as responsible for this as is McCain. And Sarah Palin wants to claim that she still has some sort of mantle of respectability in the national political scene. I disagree vehemently with that position. She could have stood up at that point. She could have, if she felt that it would have been inappropriate as his running mate at the time, she certainly could have said something about it after he lost. She's done neither. She's had several years to think about it, and she apparently doesn't seem to have any problem with what he did. The reality of the situation is that I cannot vote for a man that tells me he's going to bend me over the table and take turns. So that was the logic behind it. I wrote a very long ticker about it at the time explaining why I could not cast a vote for McCain.
Obama might have done it, but at least he didn't promise he was going to do it.
Well, Obama promised that he was coming to Washington for purposes other than bailing out the bankers and screwing the American public. He lied. Okay. This is the risk you take when you elect a politician. Many of them lie. That's not uncommon.
Wait, what? Does CBS know about this?
Yeah. So, I can't say that I'm surprised that he lied. I think that you have to look at things as what they are, okay? And what I look at here is that this really isn't all that surprising that he lied, but at the same time I look at the other side of things and say, okay, is that it really any different? And I think to some degree it is. Am I happy about what has happened here? No, I'm most certainly not happy in any stretch of the imagination. I mean, certainly, in addition to all of the stuff with Goldman Sachs officials and Federal Reserve Bank of New York. Okay, I mean, let's not forget TurboTax Timmy. We also have the revolving door games with the SEC. The fact that they seem to think that their highest and best use of their time is to surf porn sites on the web.
Arguably less harmful than many of the things that most government officials do.
Well, I suppose. I mean, as long as you keep the door closed, right? I don't want to see any pictures from, like Weiner. But I just look at all of the things that have gone on here and I say, okay, would it have been any better under McCain? The answer is no. Would we have gotten something that is at least as bad or worse? Yeah. What options are we being presented with this time around? And the answer so far is damn few. Hopefully that changes.
Well, speaking of that, based on your strongly anti-banking perspective and the importance that you put on McCain's support for TARP and Palin's support for TARP, a lot of people would assume that you were a Ron Paul supporter, but you've been extremely critical of him as well to the extent that you've completely written him off as a candidate. Is it correct to conclude from this that you see foreign policy as being ultimately more important than domestic policy?
No. What's correct to conclude from that is that what Ron Paul espouses won't actually solve the problem. Ron Paul, unfortunately, and I can't get in the guy's head, okay, so I can only tell you what makes logical sense with all of the time that I've spent talking to and working with people in Washington, D.C. I've been fairly heavily involved in that now for close to 20 years in one form or another. When I ran my internet company, I was constantly on the phone with people in the Beltway and outside. The I screwed up three words is not just a Ben Bernanke problem, okay? They're never uttered by anybody in Congress except when they get caught like Weiner did yesterday. Other than that, it never happens. And unfortunately, what Ron Paul believes is that if we were to return to a gold standard, that this would somehow solve problems. In fact, it would actually make the problem worse. What needs to happen is we need to have teeth in whatever monetary policy, whatever governing board we have, whether we have a Federal Reserve or we have somebody else that governs monetary policy, somebody has to do the job. Now, the last thing I want to have happen under any set of circumstances is for Barney Frank to have the power of how much credit and money to admit into the economy. Right? We would instantaneously detonate if that was to happen. So even though we have an illusion of an independent central bank that is not true, it is entirely possible to go from, you know, from Beelzebub to Cthulhu and get eaten anyway. As a result, I have a real problem with much of what Ron Paul has introduced. Abolishing the Fed would not fix anything, but he could insert the punishment language from the Coinage Act, going back to the late 1700s, for example. He could introduce a bill to put that punishment language into the Federal Reserve Act and define stable prices as zero inflation over the intermediate term and put a time on it, let's say 5 years. Okay.
But how is setting the specifics or setting the laws more correctly going to help when we've already seen from the 1980s on that the officials charged with enforcing those laws simply refuse to enforce them?
Because there's no or else in the law. See, this is the problem. The problem isn't that the laws are incorrect. The laws have all of the necessary strictures in there. Prompt corrective action will prevent the FDIC from ever losing a nickel in the deposit fund.
I see. What you're saying is similar to the sentencing guidelines that over the last 20 years have been imposed on judges because the judges can't be trusted to put anyone in jail after they axe murder 20 people.
Well, yes and no. I mean, here's the basic problem is that if you look in the Federal Reserve Act says that the Federal Reserve will manage monetary and credit aggregates. In other words, they get it right, okay? The issue is not the total amount of money in the system. It's money and credit in the system. So
Agreed.
As to produce stable prices, okay? Well, Ben Bernanke and everybody before him, by the way, has taken the word stable and defined that as 2% inflation.
Right.
Well, 2% inflation robs, you know, 70-80% of your purchasing power over 100 years. Stable is not 2% inflation. Stable is unchanging. It's a clean word defined in the dictionary.
It's zero.
Yeah, it's zero. It's defined in the dictionary, okay? There isn't any argument over what the language says. The problem is there is no or else. There is nothing in there that says these are what you will do or you'll do 10 years in federal prison, okay? Now, think about the bank robbery statute. The bank robbery statute says thou shalt not rob banks. And if you decide that you're going to do it anyway, you're going to do 20 years in the can. Okay? So we have the first part of the law, but the second clause is missing. As long as that second clause remains missing, there's nothing you can do to fix the problem because there's no penalty for violating what the law says you have to do.
That's certainly coherent. Let's end on a morbidly amusing note. Today on the market ticker, you posted a study reporting that the more credit card and college loan debt held by young adults aged 18 to 27, the higher their self-esteem and the more they felt like they were in control of their lives. Is this conclusive proof that America is toast, or is it just a sign that the voting age needs to be raised to 30?
Well, I would say neither. I would say that drug abuse is an extraordinarily attractive option when it is begun, no matter what the drug is. And debt can be just as addictive as heroin. The study found that the lower socioeconomic people, when given access to something they haven't had before, tend to binge on it. This should not surprise. You probably do the same study with cocaine or you know, meth or for pretty much anything else, and find the same thing. What it really says is that we as adults, when we bring children into the world and as we educate them, and that responsibility, by the way, lies with parents. It doesn't lie with the schools because the schools are not going to do this. The government is captured by the bankers, as I'm sure you know, and if you don't at this point, you're not very bright. We have a responsibility to explain these kinds of things, and we have a responsibility as parents and adults to go on strike when it comes to enabling this sort of behavior. The financial industry will not do it on their own, but we as individuals and as adults have the absolute power to do so with our children. There is no way that your kid can get himself in this kind of trouble if you refuse to file a FAFSA because you have to file that in order to get access to that money. We need to cut that off. That has to stop.
Carl Denninger, economic rock star, the market ticker, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Anytime.
You've been listening to Voxic Shock, and no, you can't have a pony. Audio production on Voxic Shock by GoodmanShow.com. Revolutionary audio.